Episode 16, Season 2. The journey very much continues, and oh my word, have we got one hell of a listen for you today. Welcome to The Rut, the podcast which delves into the minds of men from all walks of life to find answers to some of the burning questions in and around the murky world of men's mental health. This week I am joined by somebody who many of you won't know. I think it's fair to say that, and you won't mind me saying this either. Some of you might, but most of you won't. However, this guy has a phenomenal story, all of which is centered around how an eating disorder destroyed parts of his life. How obsessive, compulsive exercising controlled parts of his life. How binge eating disorders has controlled parts of his life. George Mycock is the founder of MyoMinds, a mental health platform which exposes the stories and the harsh realities of mental health in men and women, much like this podcast, although we are obviously solely aimed at men. George also educates people on the brutal realities of eating disorders, body dysmorphia, compulsive exercise disorder, something which is hugely common in men actually, but rarely spoken about, is hugely stigmatized. Where did this all start with George? Well, George broke his neck playing rugby when he was 13 and subsequently gained almost 8 stone in a year because of his injury. He off the back of that, he developed an obsessive exercise disorder, bulimia, and a obsessive eating disorder, and at one stage was eating only an apple and half a banana, one apple and half a banana, whilst exercising compulsively for several hours, all at the age of 15. His eating disorder completely took over his life. He continued to struggle with his relationship with food and exercise throughout his late teens, and it came to quite an ugly head at uni, where again everything became too much because he developed a binge eating disorder and bulimia. This episode is incredible. We really do dig into the psychology behind eating disorders in men and women, body dysmorphia, compulsive exercise disorder, and more. And also, I think critically, we understand how George regained control of his eating disorder, his compulsive exercise disorder. I hope this is going to really help a lot of people. It helped me sitting there for, yes, it's long, for 2 hours, but I learned a huge amount off this guy. He's currently doing masters in this topic and looking at doing a PhD, but also he's built a business around educating people on what eating disorders, obsessive exercise disorders, bulimia, how it can affect athletes. He's built a business around this stuff, so he knows what he's talking about. So I'm absolutely delighted he's come on today. If you're struggling with an eating disorder right now, or you think you are, or you're struggling with your relationship with food or exercise, you feel like it's potentially taking over your life, you're finding it difficult to cope, I'm going to attach links in the show notes below of places you can find support you need. And I'll also provide links to George and MyoMind, so you can get in touch if this resonates with you. He'd absolutely love to hear from you. So, George Mycock, welcome to The Rut. Please leave all judgment at the door. My man, how are you?
I am grand, mate. How are you?
I'm really, really well, actually. It's been a good couple of weeks since we went to Turkey, and I always
been
say
to Turkey. I didn't know you've been to Turkey.
Yeah, went to Turkey 3 weeks ago, literally off the cuff. Boris came on the TV on ITV News with Peston and Robert Peston.
I thought you were gonna say Boris came up to me and said,
"No,
look, you can go to Turkey."
No, Yeah, I won't actually reveal my political persuasion on the podcast.
Not a good idea.
Yeah. No, because I don't. This podcast doesn't need to get political at all. Although we actually do have some political figures.
Yeah.
Annoyingly, yeah. Not annoyingly is the wrong word. I'll edit that out. Boris was on Peston on ITV, and he was, and it was very clear that we were going into another period of lockdown. So I turned round to Abby and I was just like, we've got to go. So we went, did a full week, and yeah, I mean, it was great weather, 31 degrees. Our hotel, it was like being in a hotel with the entirety of Moscow. Came back, and then 3 days later, Turkey was put on the quarantine list, and I was like, well done.
Smashed it. Absolutely smashed it. Honestly, I can't remember the last time I went on holiday. I actually can't. When would it have been? It probably, I went on a pseudo holiday to North Carolina, but it was more of like a volunteering trip to like help out with this thing that they were doing, this bridges project thing, which is beside the point. But I think that's the last time I went on holiday. Ever since I started my master's and have now finished it, so last September till now, I basically spent my entire life indoors or within a gym. And that had just been going back and all lectures, obviously, just going back and forth between different rooms.
You need to get a holiday.
I do. I really do. But for that, I also need to get money. And that's
the true.
Issue.
Yeah. Yeah. That, one of the issues with the area we're in, like, there's not that much money in mental health yet.
Yeah.
We'll see if we can try and change that.
Yeah. Hopefully.
Thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, it's
my pleasure. We've been trying to do this for months.
Forever. We spoke about your podcast before it was the podcast.
It launched. Yeah, I know. That is ridiculous.
It's insane.
It's insane. Thank you very, very much for coming on. You have one of the most fascinating stories. How old are you, by the way?
I am 24 years old.
Yeah, for a 24-year-old, fuck me, you've done a lot. And you've had a very interesting time of it, I would say. I mean, we're talking off air, and I was literally like, oh my word, in my head. I didn't actually say it to you. I was like, fucking hell.
I'll take that as a compliment.
It's crazy. Yeah, so I'm really excited to get this one out there. Let's start at the beginning. I'm not going to start at day one, coming out your mother's womb, but I presume that's where you came out.
I remember that day fondly.
Yes.
That was creepy. Take that out of the podcast. That was weird.
Take me back to starting life on a zoo.
Starting life on a zoo. Okay. For the listeners, I grew up living on a zoo, which is a very strange childhood. Basically, what happened was I was born, and my dad was a zookeeper. The head zookeeper, actually, at a zoo, which I won't reveal the name of because I don't want any people coming and stalking me or killing me. I'm sure none of your listeners are murderers, but there's always one.
You never know.
But yeah, my dad was the head zookeeper, and my mum was kind of like the head, like administrator. I don't really know what her official role was, but she was like the head administratory person. So my entire childhood, from birth until about, I think, 10 or 11 years old, weekdays I would go to school. Obviously I would, I'd wake up in the morning, go to school. At the end of school, either one of the zookeepers or my mum and my dad would pick me up in like the zoo's van that often would have like, you know, an animal in the back or like some kind of food in the back or something like that. We would then drive off to the zoo. I would spend the evening helping out, feeding animals, looking after animals, new pens, whatever. And then I would go to sleep on a little cottage that was on the zoo. We actually had a house outside the zoo as well, like in a little town nearby. But I very rarely like was there. On weekends sometimes, if my mum and dad had like days off, we'd go back to there. But then weekends as well, often I'd work at the zoo as well, so like just looking after animals. So I was constantly surrounded by, you know, like snakes, and I've held penguins and, like, I don't know, done whatever people do on zoos.
Interesting. And then your talk to me about your dad.
Because my dad.
Your dad actually, your dad has had an extraordinary influence on your life, right? As most dads do, to be fair.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Yours has got a particular story around it, which has, I suppose, well, I'm hoping we'll find out, bred a series of issues that have
arisen.
To the fore throughout your life. So, yeah.
Before I do that, I'm just going to, you can edit this down. I'm going to shut my bedroom window because of the dog that's barking.
No, we never edit on this podcast, actually.
You don't? Okay, well.
Well, I think one of the, we try not to edit too much unless something catastrophic happens, but no, it's nice. It's better raw.
Then you all just listen to what I think was my crotch rub against the mic as I stood up to touch to close the window. So you're all very welcome. My dad. Yeah, smooth transition from my crotch to that. So my dad, growing up, as long as I can remember, my dad was a very kind of, I would say, aggressive alcoholic. Not necessarily towards me, and not in the sense that he, you know.
What do you mean by that?
He was. He would often just drink a lot and go out fighting, and then he'd come back. And then I was very young, and my mum did a very good job at hiding it from me. The details are, kind of washy. Plus, I think, you know, your brain has a very good ability at making you forget things that you don't want to remember. A lot of it isn't kind of in the forefront of my memory. But yeah, for me, it was, I had the good dad, the one that I would see like in the zoo and at home, and like, you know, is loving to my mom, myself, and my little sister, and you're just like a wonderful man. And then there would be like the 3 a.m. purse like thing that came home, and my mom would come and wake me up at like 8 years old and tell me I need to, you know, shut my door or like go look after my sister because she needs to deal with whatever's happening downstairs. So that just kind of made life just exhausting in general.
What do you remember from that though?
I remember a few things. It's difficult again. I think when,
cause that for an 8 year old is fucking difficult to go through anyway.
Yeah.
Do you know what, whether it was difficult might be the right word. It's confusing, right?
Yeah. Yeah. That's one of the things as well. Cause I think, yeah, I didn't know what it was. Like, it's weird because I have the memories from when I didn't understand what it was. And I kind of, my childlike brain developed the memories from a standpoint that didn't understand what was going on. And now I'm viewing it from a standpoint where I do understand what was going on. But combining those two is weird. Like, it doesn't quite make sense in my head. And it almost feels like some of the memories are like made up. But I have like a couple that I can like confirm, I guess, that like, you know, I've spoken to my parents about and I know are kind of real. And I have one that I'm not quite sure about, but it's like very distinct in my mind. I'll go with that one first. I'm not quite sure about, but it's such a distinct memory for me. I remember this one time when I was sat in my, I was asleep in my bed, and my mum came to wake me up and said, I need to go sit in my sister's bedroom and look after my sister. And I just remember being sat like, I think my mum and dad were like arguing, but my dad was like trying to get into the room with my sister and me for whatever reason. Like, I can firmly say he never did anything to me or my sister ever.
Of course.
But he was trying to get in. And I think he used to feel bad and feel like he wanted to make amends like whilst he was drunk, but he was too drunk to do that. But he felt like he felt so upset about it that he wanted to come in and like, you know, say, oh, it's okay. But he just couldn't. So my mum was like trying to stop. And I just remember they were like, struggling like outside the bedroom, and like I could hear like feel them like bang against the door. Like I don't know what kind of, you know, like, yeah, they were fighting in some kind of manner. And I just remember putting my feet up against the bed, like, because my sister's bed was like next to the door, or like close to the door. I remember like putting my like shoulders on the, or like hands and shoulders on the door, and then my like legs and my feet on the bed to like push against it. And I just remember like pushing against the door, because it wasn't like a lock on my sister's door. So I used to just have like hold it. I can't remember how old I was here. I do remember though I was wearing Thomas the Tank Engine socks, so I was relatively young, but I think I still had them even when I was a little bit older. I remember that one very distinctly. I remember like holding the door shut, and that was horrible, because it was just weird, because it just wasn't like, because like, I wake up the next day and see my dad, and he's like, you know, he's hungover or whatever, but he's like, he's fine, he's just a normal bloke, like he's just my dad. And
did it's you just ever weird. Ask him like did, sorry to interrupt, but did you ever, what am I trying to say? Did you ever ask him what triggered his alcoholism?
Yeah. Well, he spoke about it quite a lot, and it's, I think for a lot of addiction issues, it comes down to fear. You're so scared that of what might happen if you don't drink. So, you know, for him, his story, right. He kind of drank at a very young age, started drinking at a very young age, and, you know, he says that he felt good when he drank, like he felt like people liked him more, and he, you know, people just like enjoyed his company more. So then it switched to, if I don't drink, people won't like me. And so it comes from a fear, usually. That's what it is. That's where it comes from. A fear of what might happen if I don't do it. And that can come with withdrawal symptoms as well. Like, you know, if you're drinking a lot, and you know, people who, you know, alcoholics who are trying to stop drinking, you know, obviously you have the withdrawal symptoms as well. And that can play into it. But a lot of the time it is like the 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous, a big part of that is they talk about making amends of things.
Yeah, yeah.
You kind of list all the bad things that happen.
Yeah, and I've heard that before.
Yeah. Mm. And I think the reason that works is because it gets rid of that fear. Like you're basically taking away all these things that you might feel scared might happen. I think that's a big reason why that helps.
Whilst this obviously isn't really a podcast about your dad, it's more a podcast episode about you. We were talking before, and having done a little bit of research into your own story, you were talking about how you kind of had no energy for social settings. Which was a resulting factor of the alcoholism. Like, how did that transpire? Why did that manifest in that way, do you think? And what actually did it manifest into?
So the you cut out a little bit there when you were talking. So what I'm thinking you said was, because I kind of, you know, I was dealing with my dad and stuff, it meant that I didn't
have energy
for social settings. And
yeah, exactly. That, like, yeah. How did why did it manifest like that?
So it like the whole, you know, I just spoke about the you know, having to get up in the early nights and deal with something that I didn't really understand or get. And having to, deal with all that, as well as just kind of you being a kid and dealing with, you know, school and life and whatever. I, you know, it was just exhausting. I was just genuinely just exhausted to the point that, you know, generating your kind of social skills and just socializing with people at a young age is quite a tiring thing. You know, you've got to learn how to communicate with people. You've got to learn how to feel emotions, and you've got to make or break you actually. Yeah. Yeah. And you've got to understand, the difference between being angry and being upset. You know, those are things that we all take for granted, but you learn that at a young age you learn that, you know, if I feel this way, it's because I'm pissed off that this has happened, and you know, or you know, I'm feeling this way, it's because, you know, I'm upset that this thing's happened, and it's my fault. You know, I never learned any of that. Like, I genuinely just never understood how kind of social situations and emotions and things really worked, because I was too tired to bother when I was younger, and I didn't want to speak to people because it just seemed like too much effort for me. Like, it was just, I had so much to deal with in my head and just at home and everything, that I just didn't want to deal with all that. So I never really learnt. And you know, that kind of led to some issues in the future. And I ended up kind of, you know, trying, somewhat learning that myself with a counsellor like down the road, but I'm sure we'll speak about that in a moment.
Very interesting. Let's talk about rugby. Shared passion, interest of ours. But rugby seemingly was a big part of your life, right? Until it was cut short.
Yeah. So, talking about this kind of, you know, lack of social ability or whatever, you know, when I started getting a little bit older, you're probably like, I'm going to say like 10, maybe like 9 or 10. I started playing rugby, and my dad was always a rugby player when he was younger. He's quite like renowned in my local town's rugby club. So everyone kind of knew him as a rugby guy. And I was the biggest kid in school for a lot of time. Like, I'm quite just a naturally big guy. So I took on rugby and I was good at rugby. And what rugby gave me was a way to communicate with people that was easy, and a way for people to like me and for me to fit in. Because even though I didn't have time for social settings, no one wants to feel like the odd one out, or no one wants to feel like the one that people find weird, or, you know, can't talk to people, or, you know, just uncomfortable in social situations. So rugby gave me, it was, people liked me because I played rugby, because I was good at rugby. Like, all my teammates thought I was great because I was you know, winning games, or, you know, doing big tackles or whatever I was doing. You know, people, like PE teachers respected, like, I felt like they respected me more because, you know, I was good at rugby. And then when I was at school, you know, I would always get picked in the rugby team. And, you know, like, it gave me a sense of, it was who I was. And I basically just put my entire existence, my entire self-worth into being a rugby player. So at, you know, 13 years, when it got to 13 years, which is when the event happened, which I'm going to talk about in a second, I was just a rugby player. Like, that's all I was. That's all I spoke about.
Did you feel good enough when you played rugby?
When I was playing, I felt good because I was good at it. Like, I was, you know, obviously I was only 13, but, you know, I was a good player. Like, I think most of my coaches and stuff said I was really good, and they, you know, and to be honest, my plan was to become a professional rugby player. Like, that's all I wanted, and that was kind of, because that's all I felt that I was. You know, I felt good enough within rugby, but I didn't think I ever like properly processed it because I was too young. But, you know, later on in life, I've realized that a big issue within my psychology, and the reason why I have my lacking mental health in a lot of ways is a lack of self-worth. And it's something I've had to work on. You know, and I'm much better now. You know, I still have, you know, times where, you know, I'm up and down, you know, especially kind of at the moment with everything going on and stuff. You know, it's difficult for everyone. But that was my, you know, in my lowest point, it was just, I was worthless. Like, I genuinely just, I was trying to cling on to whatever I could to make myself feel worthy in whatever way I could. And when I was 13, rugby was what I used, and it was kind of the first thing that I did use.
Just to take us back as well. Your dad had stopped playing rugby because he had suffered a brain hemorrhage, right?
Yeah. So my dad, like I said, he was a renowned player in the local kind of rugby team. Like, I'm probably misquoting this, but I believe at like 14 or 15 years old, because obviously back then it was maybe a little bit more lenient, but he played in like the full adult team when he was like 15, 14. And just because he was great, and he was like naturally the same as me, just a big kid. He was like, you know, getting on 6 foot when he was like 15. So, sure. He was just very good. He was one of those guys that would, you know, he's got two big scars above his eyebrows because they used to split open every game. He'd get them stitched on the sideline and go back and play again. And like, he was just that guy. Like, he loved the sport, didn't give a shit about getting hurt, and just, he was just great at it. But that led to huge injury where basically he got a brain hemorrhage, which, if people don't know, basically means your brain's bleeding. And he nearly died from it. So now he had to get like drilled into his skull, basically
to release
and to drain the blood out. But luckily he lived and survived. My dad, I guess I'll kind of go with my dad's story here, but yeah, my dad, since then, with his drinking, obviously he stopped drinking. He actually reached 10 years sober like a week ago or a couple
Is he
weeks
fully
ago,
sober? Fully sober? Like, yeah, doesn't touch a drop?
He's never drank for 10 years straight, not one bit of alcohol.
I'm sure you have asked him this, but I'm quite interested. Like, does he think that if he... Is he one of these people that you hear if they had a drop of alcohol touch their lips, for example, it would just swing them the other way? And so for him, a bit like Russell Brand, I suppose, like there's a worry that you have one or two and it leads to 22 and it's just a complete relapse.
I can't technically, you know, I think I would be wrong to quote the actual organization that my dad used because of the nature of the organization. But the organization that he has kind of worked through and we help with now tends to remain anonymous, and the people within it tend to remain anonymous, so you don't tend to talk about it. But yeah, the program that they use, and Russell Brand is famous for talking about this program, they often say that you need to stop drinking altogether and you can't drink. And that's kind of part of the program itself, is that you just don't. So it's not whether... I don't think it's the case that if he had a drop... Because actually, you know what? I lied earlier, because he did tell me a couple of days ago, he, at one stage, I didn't tell me exactly when, but at one stage he did accidentally drink a sip of Coke and brandy or something, because he thought it was a Coke. So he did accidentally drink one, but he was fine. But it's more the program itself that, you know, he used.
I suppose that wasn't quite what I was getting. I appreciate that, like, you can't talk really about the organization, etc., and the steps they use are I suppose they're relatively common in the AA circles in terms of sobriety. But like, it, from a personal standpoint, like, does he think he's the type of person that down that route?
I think he's I don't believe that he would, but he believes that he shouldn't ever drink. Like, he's never just going to be like, I'm just going to have one, or like, as far as he's concerned, he's never going to drink.
Okay. We digress slightly, because obviously you've had your own horrific rugby injury, which was you broke your spine.
That is
savage.
Yeah, it wasn't great. It was originally a stress fracture, and then due to some impact, which was basically me hitting a rock. So it wasn't even getting tackled or anything cool. I just ran into a rock and then it just went.
How old were you?
I was 13, so that 13.
Yeah, so you're kind of, your body's still developing, and you've just hit a rock and your spine's kind of crumpled and folded.
Yeah, well, it's just kind of broken all the way through the vertebrae. And I actually played, kind of my claim to fame here is I actually played on for like 5 minutes. The surgeon told me that I was about an inch and a half or so away from my spinal cord. So yeah. That's why I didn't get paralyzed. Otherwise I probably would have been paralyzed. If it was any higher up, I probably would have been paralyzed and very dangerous, but it's still obviously very dangerous, but not as dangerous as it could have been. I played on, cause I think I just went into shock. It hurt really sharply for like a second, and then it didn't hurt. And then it slowly got like more painful as I played on for those 5 minutes. And then I just had to go off.
Okay. Very interesting. And I mean, now we kind of get into the mental health story, right? Albeit, you've had an alcoholic dad and I wouldn't say a difficult upbringing, but you've had a very unconventional upbringing and had several challenges that go with that. But we now get into the world of eating disorders. That for me, I've explored one other eating disorder with somebody, a guy called Nick Ead. I suppose Tom Lindsay as well in season one was binge eating, but we didn't quite cover that much. But we've had one other, Nikki having an eating disorder that I can think of off the top of my head. I might be doing a disservice to somebody here, but anyway, I'm rambling. What What is? I've got so many things here.
The issue with my life, there being like, you know, obviously we're going by point, but there's my life's so kind of everywhere, like all the things that have gone on, that it is quite difficult to follow a narrative. And so I don't
particularly want to follow a narrative, actually. I think we have this chat about what the fuck has happened and just explore it and see how many people we can enlighten with this.
Yeah. That's the Netflix documentary about my life. What the fuck has happened?
It's kind of how the gist of the podcast has run in season one, and I suppose going in season two. So in your words, let's talk eating disorders. What does it mean to you? Because you've like rugby, and let's give some context here. As I understand it, rugby has been your self-worth. It is what you've got on a rugby pitch. And you've broken your back at the age of 13, but you've got on a rugby pitch and that is where you felt worthy. That's taken away from you. And this is quite common, actually, from the conversations I've had. And once that's taken away from you, you feel like, what the hell's happened here?
Yeah.
So when rugby's taken away from you, how did it feel to not have self-worth? And then how did that manifest into food?
So, yeah, the way it felt, originally it was just kind of, I think often people describe depression as kind of a numb feeling, not necessarily sad, you just kind of feel numb. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what I felt. I didn't really know what it was. But a bit of context about my back. So I broke it and I actually had to wait because it wasn't near enough to my spinal cord. It wasn't necessarily an emergency for me to get it sorted. So I had to wait about 9 months for the surgery, and I could barely walk. So I was lying down on my back for 9 months, just doing nothing. And my way of kind of dealing with the emotions where I started emotionally eating. And also, like, if people came to visit me, they would just buy me food, because what do you buy a guy who's got a broken back, like, other than just some food? So I gained loads of weight. I gained a lot of weight. And when I kind of returned to school after about a year, since after the kind of operation and stuff, so, you know, a year of not doing anything, I had gone from being, I reckon, about 10 or 11 stone to about 19 and a half stone. So that's like 60 kilo or something to about 130 kilo. So I was like...
In how long? Sorry.
In a year. So I was like obese. Like, I was very, very overweight.
So from the age of 13 to 14, you put on how many stone?
From like 11-ish to like 9.5, so like 8 stone, something like that.
How the hell did you manage that?
I ate a lot. Like, when I say I was emotionally eating, like, people just buy me cakes and buy me stuff. Like, I was stuffing my face because that was I used to deal with my emotions, basically.
Did you at the time, this is so interesting. I mean, did you at the time, when you were putting the food in your mouth, I appreciate, what are you, 13, 14 at the time? So actually there's just a complete lack of like conceptual understanding of what the hell you're doing. But there must have been some feelings attached to that. Like, did you have any idea? Like, what did it feel like? I just put on 7-8 stone in a year is...
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Well, the thing is, because obviously that's quite a considerable amount, it's a lot of weight to put on, but it happens periodically. Like, so for me, you know, I witness myself every second of every day, so of course, it's still gradual to me. Like, it didn't seem sudden to me. Obviously, to the people who hadn't seen me, you know, if you didn't see me for 6 months and then you came back and I put on this huge amount of weight, it was dramatic. But to me, it just didn't, like, I just, you know, it was slow, it was gradual. I didn't even realize. And, you know, before this had happened, you know, I was just like, kind of, you know, I don't want to say normal, but, you know, my body image was like natural, and like I wasn't concerned about the way I looked at all. So just, I wasn't even thinking about it really. You know, I was just putting on weight and whatever, like I didn't care. It wasn't until I went back to school and, you know, people noticed, and, you know, I didn't get bullied, but, you know, people were outright about the fact that I'd obviously put on weight, and, you know, I could, I could tell people were treating me differently, and you know,
it's also dangerous that, because when you're going back to school at the age of 14, having put on 7 stone,
yeah, missed a year of school, hadn't seen anyone for a year, and then
it is really easy as a young kid to misinterpret that and go the wrong way. Not actually from you, but from the people who are experiencing through their eyes this visual change.
For the people who were at school and stuff in my year, or whoever who knew me before, and yeah, especially the kids who I wasn't necessarily close friends with, so like I didn't see them during, you know, when I had my back, like they didn't come around to visit, but you know, I was kind of like, you know, I don't know what you want to call them, I'd say friends, but you know, like not close, you know, they didn't see me for the whole year, and I came back and I was 8 stone heavier, you know, and so obviously it was dramatic, and for them, like, you know, I got that. Yeah, and the thing is as well, when you're that overweight, like you sweat a lot, and you know, I remember I carried deodorant with me everywhere I went, and every single opportunity, and I was embarrassed by it because people, you know, I didn't want people to see me putting it on. But you know, I was constantly and even to this day, I know I've next to me, I've got 3 cans of deodorant and an aftershave. I'm like so obsessed with smelling good because that's just instilled a fear into me. I actually remember when I was a kid, I won't mention the guy's name, but there's a guy who I don't really speak to him anymore like that much, but I've seen him occasionally. I remember I was walking home from school with like 3 of my mates, and I went up my drive as they were like carrying on down the street, and I just heard one of them say, "Oh, George stinks, don't he?" And I was just like, it literally like ripped my heart out, like through, because I had so little self-worth. I was clinging on to whatever self-worth I could. That comment just destroyed me. Like, not only was I, you know, as I thought, this like fat, worthless human being who can't play rugby anymore, now has nothing. I was also, you know, I smelt bad, and you know, I looked bad or whatever. And just, yeah, my entire world just became focused on the fact that I had all these things, these shortcomings and these issues. It was very frustrating and just confusing and difficult. That's when I started trying to lose weight. And that's where the kind of, you know, this eating disorder starts. So, you know,
just before we go into the eating disorder, I've explored the concept of self-worth with a few people now. It is a very, very common theme, of course. Mm-hmm. Like, what do you think it is?
Self-worth?
Yeah.
I think our brains are, you know, this is kind of evolutionary psychology, and I'm no qualified psychologist, so, you know, it's hopefully one day. I think our brains are designed to structure a hierarchy within our social group. You know, we're designed to see where we are, and we're designed to, you know, move that social hierarchy depending on where we are. So, you know, as your podcast gets bigger and you start talking with more people, you're going to start comparing yourself to people who are doing more than you. So, you know, if you
all the time.
Yeah. If you 6 months ago had looked at you now, you'd have think like, holy shit, that guy's really fucking cool. He's speaking to all these guys. But I bet right now you just compare yourself to other people who are doing cool, like, you know, bigger podcasts or speaking to like,
oh yeah. I never stop and stand there and be like, oh yeah, you're doing a great job. It's always like,
yeah,
for me,
yeah,
it's relentless. It's that's how, it's kind of how Abby describes me, really, is like, although just to the outside world, I don't know what the hell they think of me. And to be honest, I don't really care anymore. But that's been a process of like, we'll talk about that in a bit, but it's just this relentless
thing, and I
in
think
my head that's, yeah.
It's evolutionary psychology kind of, but it's the idea, you know, our brains, think of it from a kind of like an animalistic brain, something that you do that is positive and you know, something that you're doing well, you've done it, like it's complete. It's a thing that you've manifested, you've created, you've done. So you don't need to think about it anymore because it's good. It's a good thing. It's positive to your life. So there's no reason to build upon that because you've got it. Now we need to find something else that's good and add that to our lives. When something negative happens, or you do things that are like bad, or, you know, something doesn't go as well as you thought it would, that's an issue. That's scary. That's, that's something that needs to be fixed. So we need to fucking focus on that, because like we know that shit's bad. You know, this guy's doing, he's got more podcast views than I have, or, you know, this guy's talking to this guy, you know, whatever, you know, you're constantly gonna, your brain is just designed to look for these things and highlight them. And I think when you're someone who has a low sense of self-worth, I think the hierarchy that you're looking at, you're positioning yourself lower, like constantly. You're frantically searching for things to prove to yourself that you are lower within this hierarchy. I think that's something people listening to this who resonate with low self-worth, or like feel that they have low self-worth, will agree with, that you constantly like the rumination, like constant thinking about things. You become the best detective in the world at trying to find shit that proves that you're a piece of shit, and that you'll do whatever
that you're not good enough.
And that's what a lack of self-worth is in my eyes. It's that, yeah, it's, I think the way that you fix that, and the way that a lot of people fix it, is, you know, developing a mindset that, you know, where you begin to look at the positives, and you also begin to catch yourself with these kind of irrational ruminations, these irrational thoughts of constantly, you're that investigator trying to find shit that proves that you're a piece of shit. You know, you kind of start to block that out. I think that's where that kind of, you know, that self-worth starts to come in, where, you know, like a normal human being, you know, I don't want to say normal again, but, you know, someone who has a higher sense of worth doesn't constantly try and find things that proves that they're shit.
Of course. Interesting. Fascinating. Let's move back into eating disorders, because it is one of the deepest and I think most interesting world surrounding mental health. How did like your eating disorder manifest over time? Obviously we've got the weight gain after the rugby incident, and then by this stage you're like 15-16, right?
It's all kind of happened quite, so I was like 14, yeah, and then the eating disorder started happening probably like late 14/15.
Okay.
So it's quite a quick turnaround. And this kind of alludes to a good point that I'll come on to now in a second. So I gained all this weight, and like I thought, you know, the way I need to fix this is by losing weight. So I started going to a family friend's gym that they had in a garage that was like up the road. It was just like rusty dumbbells and like a treadmill, and just started doing exercise, started eating less. And I found that, you know, when I started losing weight, people congratulated me. You know, my surgeon congratulated me, said it was amazing. So I started exercising more. I started eating less. And so I lost weight faster. So then, you know, more praise. Oh my, like you're losing weight even faster. That's incredible. You know, there's a funny thing. If you're starving yourself and exercising loads and you're really thin and skinny, it's an issue and you need to sort your head out. But if you're overweight or obese and you're starving yourself and exercising loads, you're a hero. Like an inspiration. The thing, you know, you mentioned earlier, you know, you said that eating disorders are one of the most interesting parts of mental health. And I can't stress enough that's the case. It's mental health. An eating disorder is not a physical manifestation. You can have anorexia and be overweight. I was still overweight when I started starving myself and exercising all the time. That's anorexia. The fact that my behavior was anorexia-esque, it doesn't matter if you're super thin, super skinny. And, you know, one of the if people want to, you know, learn more about that, look up recently on my podcast, I spoke to Hope Virgo, her name is, and she's a mental health campaigner, started the hashtag Dump the Scales campaign, which is basically to be diagnosed with anorexia or to receive treatment for anorexia, you have to hit a certain level of a BMI, like a certain low amount of BMI, which is like, I don't know off the top of my head, but I think it's like 13 or 14 or something like really low. So you can be like thin, starving yourself, exercising all the time, like in a dangerous level, but you aren't thin enough, so you don't get help. So you know, people with anorexia who are, you know, very thin and going through all this trauma and issues are almost encouraged to get thinner and get skinnier so that you can get help. And that's
I think that, so George, I think the important thing here though is people listening to this or watching it maybe later on YouTube when this goes up, like, well, my immediate reaction to that is I can totally see what you're saying, but I'm sure there'll be people out there who'd be like, well, what happens if you're dieting, right? And in essence, you were dieting. And I think what we need to discuss is like where there's a fine line between starving yourself because you're on the, I don't know what diet you're on, a plethora of different diets out there, God knows how many are. Anyway, like you're on a diet. Then there's a point where it becomes dangerous though.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Well, what's that point? Because you've been through this, you've researched it. Like, where's the point that becomes dangerous?
Well, the part of an eating disorder that defines an eating disorder is the fact that it's a like compulsive behavior. So it's required, it's needed. So, right. You know, if you're dieting and, you know, you're doing it because you want to lose weight, but you know, if you stopped or if something, you know, you don't get any like impairment from it. But if you're doing that diet and you're exercising lots and stuff, and you know, if something happens that stops it, you like, hate yourself, you know, you feel suicidal, you have an intense fear when you eat a piece of cake or eat something that's out of your calorie expenditure or whatever, and you have these issues that come with it, that anxiety, absolutely, that fear, yeah, that guilt. That's where the issue is. That's when it can become dangerous within a mental health capacity. Obviously, also if you become very low body weight, you can go into, there's a thing called Red S or relative energy deficiency in sport, and which basically describes the plethora of issues that come physiologically when you aren't consuming enough food and you're doing too much, like you're expending a lot of energy. And so basically, you know, in females often it's like loss of menstrual cycle, but also, you know, you there's so many things that happen. You get osteoporosis, you begin to like faint, you know, your cognition works better, you know, the glucose in your blood, you know, glucose is one of the few nutrients that can cross the blood-brain barrier. So your brain runs mostly on glucose. So if you're not consuming enough food in order to replenish your glucose, you're going to start, your cognitive processes are going to be a lot worse as well. So, you know, there's a load of things that can happen from that. I kind of lost my train of thought now, but yeah.
take me back to, this is quite interesting actually. Something just popped to my mind. Like, take me back to the height of your like 15, 16, maybe, I don't know, maybe a little bit older. And this has become a problem. But in your mind, I assume it wasn't a problem because it was your way of life. It was your way of actually proving to yourself that you are kind of good enough, right? But like, take me back. Was it food that first became the problem and then exercise? Like, just give me some context there.
It was both at the same time. Often within the kind of research around compulsive exercise and disordered eating, they tend to go hand in hand. They tend to happen at the same time. It's not always, but it's very, very strong. So they tend, you know, very commonly it's the same time. For me, it was, my eating disorders are interesting because I went through anorexia and then it kind of converted into bulimia and binge. And then now it's kind of binge eating disorder, but we'll get into that in a bit, I'm sure. But when you're kind of in the heat of it, because when I was like 15, 16, it was still, I think, kind of anorexia-esque stuff I was within. And I think when I've spoken to people who have an eating disorder, especially within the kind of exercising community, you know, with what I do with my own minds, we all have a sense of kind of, what's the word, like grandiosity almost, or like the idea that you're better or you understand this more than other people, and that people who are trying to stop you from doing it just don't get it. Like, you know, I'm very interested in nutrition. I've just completed my master's in exercise nutrition. So I love nutrition. I find it really interesting. I didn't know as much as I did back then that I do now, but you know, I've always been interested in it. And that, so I knew that, you know, eating only an apple, but also doing three runs and a gym workout a day wasn't optimal or like healthy, but I somehow convinced myself that that was the best method for what I was doing. And that people just didn't quite understand that, you know, if I get myself into a complete minus calorie deficit, including like even excluding my BMR, you know, I can get weight loss so rapidly and get myself so lean and so shredded that, you know, people won't understand until I get there.
Hmm.
It's interesting. Your mind has such an amazing ability at convincing itself that it's right. Especially like, you know, I haven't really read into the kind of, if there's any research around that in particular, but yeah, the idea that I think just from experience myself and from speaking to other people, you somehow manage to convince yourself so wholeheartedly and so, you know, just no one can shake it that what you're doing is correct.
Yeah. Wow. How quick was the weight loss as well? You're like 15, 16, you've ballooned up to what? God, 18 stone.
Yeah.
Like how quick was that weight loss?
I can't remember. I do remember. So yeah, around 14 and a half, 15, I was like 18, 19 stone. So I think around 16, I want to say I was about 10 or 9 stone. I think the lowest I ever got to was like 8.5 or something. I thought about that recently. Cause I was on the radio, the other day.
What was day to day life like? Day to day life like?
What, so like when I was that thin and that skinny,
back to that.
Yeah. So like I said, I would eat I would try and eat 1-2 pieces of fruit a day. I'd get up. So my classic day was I'd get up in the morning, I'd go for a morning run without eating. Then I would go to school. At lunchtime at school, I would do a quick 30-minute run around the school grounds, like a few times, as many times as I could. Go home, shower, because I was lucky that I lived like literally like 30 seconds away from the school. So I'd do a run around the school grounds a few times, go home, shower, go to school, finish school, go straight to my friend's or the family friend's home gym, do a gym workout, then run on the treadmill. Normally I wouldn't have eaten by then. I'd do all that kind of fasted because I felt that I always thought that if I ate, I started feeling hungry and I wanted to postpone that as much as I possibly could. And then I'd go home and I'd eat an apple or half a banana. I would throw away half a banana because a banana has more calories than other fruits. So yeah, and that would be it. And then, you know, eventually I would feel so malnourished and couldn't eat anything that I would end up kind of binging on food. And that's when it started to kind of convert into bulimia, I think, which is when, you know, bulimia is characterized by that kind of purging, binging behavior where you eat some food, eat a load of food, stuff yourself, binge, and then you have some kind of purge. So the classic one is vomiting. So people self-induce vomiting, which is what I did.
It's just sticking your fingers down your throat and getting out.
Yeah. I don't know if you watched the Freddie Flintoff documentary, but that's what he speaks about in his, that's what he did as well. But also, you know, bulimia can be use of laxatives. Some people use, you know, the idea of exercising can be used in binging in as a purging behavior as well. So you eat loads of food and then go run half a marathon or whatever and force yourself to do exercise till you're sick, or, you know, until you feel like you've burnt enough calories. That's also a form of bulimia. So I started, bulimia-esque tendencies. It all kind of went from there.
Your compulsive exercise is quite interesting actually, because I can kind of understand why it kind of happened, but like, help me to understand a bit more. Carrot and stick, that the reward system that was being triggered every time you were going for a run, like, or you were going for a run coming back, like, fucking hell, you've lost a bit of weight, haven't you? Like, great. Okay. This, like, how did it manifest?
Yeah, so this is actually really interesting, and this is something I nerd out about within the kind of literature, so I apologize in advance if I start nerding out. But So there's two kind of terms that often get mixed up within the literature, or kind of they define them separately. So there's exercise addiction, which is kind of what you're describing there. And then there's compulsive exercise. So exercise addiction is the idea that it's a positive reinforcement. So I exercised, I felt good about that. Or, you know, people said that it was a nice thing. So then I started exercising more, and that's how it began. You know, if I do exercise, something good happens to me. So I should exercise more. That's the idea. The issue is that with me and with a lot of people is that can flick very quickly or very easily into compulsive exercise, which is, it's no longer, if I exercise, I feel good. It's if I don't exercise, I'm going to feel bad. So, and then that fear comes from that. And then the idea that you might feel guilty if you don't exercise, like what if I don't do my run, will I then later in the day feel like hate myself and feel guilty for not doing the run? And that becomes a fear. And your guilt is actually one of the like strongest correlating factors, or like thing that has a relationship with disordered eating and with compulsive exercise. So the idea of feeling guilty, and even just the research even just highlights the fear of guilt. So you don't necessarily have to actually have experienced that guilt. It's just the idea that what if I do feel guilty? And they're really common traits within compulsive exercise and within disordered eating. But yeah, so compulsive exercise itself is actually that fear of what might happen if I don't exercise, that negative.
How many people suffer with this?
Compulsive exercise and eating disorders?
What are the figures for both actually? Because I know they're huge, but compulsive exercise is very interesting.
Yeah, I'm not aware. I may have not looked into this, but I'm not aware of any kind of epidemiological research on compulsive exercise, or like stuff that looking into how many people there are. I'm sure there is, because I feel like that's a big mishap if there isn't. But my kind of thing that I look into is exercises and athletes in particular. So I know some of the figures around exercises and athletes.
Go on.
Particularly within elite athletes, it's scary for eating disorders. In elite athletes, there's been the most recent research has come out of Sweden. And then there was also one a couple of years ago coming out of Australia that showed 50% of athletes have experienced disordered eating. Which is ridiculous. So one in two, half of elite athletes from these research have experienced disordered eating.
What's your definition of an elite athlete?
It's like a professional athlete, someone whose full-time job is
right. So we're talking about football player, rugby player, cricketer. It could be a baseball player. It could be a long jump. Fine. Okay.
Yeah.
Sure. Wow. That's 50%. 50%.
Which is insane.
But doesn't that go with the nature of sport, right? Because speaking to Joe Bryant, for example, and I kind of raised the point that, and also speaking to the amount of rugby players we've had on the podcast, is the setting of which they develop and they go about their day-to-day lives is they go into the training ground, they have their breakfast, and basically they're told what to eat, they're told when to eat it, but they're basically told when to piss and shit as well. Like they're told everything in their life is regimented to the point where it becomes a bit weird when it's not. Like, surely it's the nature of sport which actually then potentially dictates these statistics and these numbers.
Yeah, so that's kind of one of the things that I'm trying to promote. A big part of what I'm trying to do with my minds is sport and exercise, quite rightly, is highlighted as this wonder drug for dealing with mental health. But actually, there are some things within sport and exercise that people need to be aware of that could have a negative effect. And it's not necessarily trying to be like, oh, don't play sport, don't do exercise. But if we're aware that these things can happen, we're more likely to steer clear from them or recognize when they are and then get help for them, rather than, you know, thinking like, you know, with me not realizing I had an eating disorder for a long time. And, you know, there's a study by Beat, who are like one of the leading eating disorder charities, and they found it's usually that's a good way to remember them. They found that it's usually around 3.5 years on average from actually starting an eating disorder, before you realize you actually have an eating disorder, to actually getting help for it. So 3.5 years is the average amount of time that someone starts their eating disorder before they actually get help. which is insane. And it's because it's not spoken about. You know, people don't realize what an eating disorder is. You know, I was just talking, and I imagine a lot of people listening to this didn't realize you could be obese and have anorexia. You just think, you think anorexia, you think a skinny person. Mm. And it can affect lots of people. But yeah, going back to exercises and athletes, quite rightly, like you said, and I've never really thought about it from the perspective that you just said then, where, you know, they have this regimented diet. But it kind of feeds into what I was, I often say, and what I've kind of planned to say for this podcast, or my notes anyway. There are three big kind of factors that often play into disordered eating and compulsive exercise, specifically disordered eating that I'm talking about here. So one is anxiety, one is guilt, and one is a weight and shape concern. So like being concerned about your weight and shape. So anxiety, being an athlete or an exerciser, so often you're put into anxious positions. So being an athlete, obviously, if you're competing in a big stage, you know, the media are watching you, etc., you're more likely going to feel anxious. And then also as an exerciser, you know, with social media and stuff, you know, you're shown to be, you need to act in a certain way, you need to do certain things, and that can cause anxiety. Guilt, like you were just saying, if you've got a regimented diet plan and you go off that diet plan, you're probably going to feel guilty about the fact that you've eaten bad, or you've eaten bad is in air quotes there. Often you're shown to, you get forced into feeling guilty. And a good example from Freddie Flintoff's documentary is, he described it as the Fat Freddie, where he put on loads of weight when he was playing cricket, and then the media called him Fat Freddie, and like, you know, he was known for this being this fat athlete. You know, that is obviously going to cause him a lot of guilt, and also is going to lead into the last one, which is this weight and shape concern. So weight and shape concern in pretty much like every study ever done in eating disorders has been shown to be something that has a really high relationship with eating disorder symptoms. So not that usually the higher someone's symptoms of eating disorders are, the higher their weight and shape concern seems to be. You could necessarily with all these things, you could say that it's other factors, but it seems so often and so repeated that I would presume that they seem to enforce each other, or they seem to have a play. But you can't say that for certain, but you know, it seems that way, at least from my opinion. So the weight and shape concern goes up, and obviously, you know, being an athlete, like, you know, Freddie Flintoff's a great example there. You know, if you're the media is telling you that you're fat, or, you know, the media is highlighting all the athletes with great, like, you know, lean physiques, and, you know, you aren't one of those athletes, you're going to be concerned about the way you look. And then obviously being an exerciser, like the entire world of the gym fitness community is look good and, you know, be a certain weight, be a certain shape. And, you know, when was the last time you heard someone say that they're going to the gym for something other than to look better? Other than, like, there are maybe some cases where someone, you know, has some kind of health concern or something, but
would you, if I said to you, I want to go in, to get stronger, that.
But usually, though, the person who says they're trying to get stronger, that also, if you pry in there, they want to get stronger because they want to be bigger, or, you know, look more muscular, more toned.
I completely agree. Yeah. No, it's all about the way you look, right?
Yeah. And I'm not saying, you know, so I'm sure there are people out there who listen to this who go to the gym just to be stronger or whatever, and don't care about that. But there's just, they're a very slim amount of people.
Yeah. The vast majority of people will go there because either they feel shit about themselves, or they think that they are going to have a better or more exciting Bumble or Hinge profile picture if they have a 17 inch bicep, right?
Yeah, exactly. And that kind of leads into, you know, the muscle dysmorphia stuff, which I also find really interesting.
And something we both share.
I do, and I know you said that you've
well, I've never had it diagnosed, but I mean,
I haven't either. I'm kind of self-diagnosed.
I look at myself and I'm like, fuck, I need to train. I look small. I don't think some days I'm like, yeah, you're in fucking great shape. That's how I think. And other days I'm like, bloody hell, you need to do some press ups. But it becomes like I'm consumed by it. I'm like, yeah, I feel shit about myself. I'm sat there feeling anxious that I've dropped half a kilo in muscle or whatever it is. I don't even know if it's muscle, but looking at myself in the mirror, being like, you need to look bigger. And I think my, the way I have progressed as a human being, as a person, being kind of bullied because I was short, and I'm only like 5'6", so I feel like I have to make up with it by having a massive chest, big shoulders, and big arms, because otherwise, what am I? I'm just a skinny, like, person who's short. And so for me, it's being gripped by my physique and being in good shape and having big arms, for me, is where I derive quite a lot of my self-worth from, actually.
And that's actually... you're saying how, you know, when you were younger, you were, you being short, you kind of, you feeling like you need to be, you need to fill in a bigger space,
or you need to make up for it somewhere.
That's quite a, there's a research by, I can't remember the guy's first name, but his last name's Nagata, something like that. And they did some research recently looking into muscle dysmorphia, and they found usually the people who have it tend to, it when in their childhood they have some kind of adverse experience of being too skinny or being too small, and then you know they need to
definitely for me it's being short and feeling like, well, if I can't make up for being short, then I can at least be shredded, or I can at least look good. I was doing, like, when I was younger, 15, 16, 17, I was doing like 150, 200 press ups, 150, 200 sit ups a day. Like, I'd be like, right, you're going to bang this. You can do 50 press ups now. And like, I had a big chest, and like, I think I was big for a short guy, I think. Although a lot of people say I was small, I was ripped and I was in good shape, but I forced myself to do it because it was my way of being like, at least that's the way I was going to get girls, essentially. And also have friends.
And it's kind of that self-worth, isn't it? It's put, you know, if you can get girls from it, and if you can get friends from it, then that must mean you're a good person. That must mean that people respect you and like you, and if people respect you and like you, then you must be great, which isn't necessarily true, but you know, and no. You know, it's the way it kind of plays in your mind. So yeah, muscle dysmorphia is interesting because I think often when you hear the phrase muscle dysmorphia, you think of just some massive bloke with tattoos and, like, you know, huge, taking steroids, etc. And a lot of the time it is, but the actual definition of muscle dysmorphia is, I've got it written down here, it encompasses the core belief that one has low or insufficient levels of muscularity, alongside a drive for improvements relating to muscle density, definition, or both. So it isn't necessarily a massive guy, it can be being ripped as well, being lean. So, you know, if people are obsessed with, you don't necessarily have to want to be massive, just wanting to be shredded and have six pack abs and have veins everywhere, that can also, you know, be the goal of someone with muscle dysmorphia. And I'm not saying, you know, people listen to this, if you just have a goal to be shredded, it doesn't mean you've got muscle dysmorphia, but it doesn't necessarily just mean huge people. Because I think people listening
will, I personally think that I immediately, when we started talking about this, I was like, that's me, because there is a thought process in your mind that you actually know isn't right. I know I shouldn't be stood in the mirror looking at myself being like, you're not big enough, go and do like 50 press-ups, or go and train, and then after I train I'm immediately satisfied that I'm big enough. I'm like, yeah, you're looking big, like, that's not a correct thought process in my opinion of myself.
And that's a big reason why, again, I keep mentioning my minds, but one of the kind of slogan, one of the big parts of the slogan of my mind is demystifying mental health. And that's because I believe that within the fitness and sporting community, it's mystical. It's like, it's a mysterious, we don't understand it. Like, no one really, because no one talks about it, because exercise is a great form of helping with mental health. It's easier and it's more brandable for companies to just say it's fantastic and not talk about the issues. But, you know, ignoring the issues, you know, people have said to me, you know, like, maybe you shouldn't talk about them, because then maybe people are more likely to be like, oh, I've got muscle dysmorphia. But if you're starting to think, oh, I have it, then you're much more likely to want to go and get help. And then if you go get help, they can tell you do or don't have it. And then, you know, people are going to get, I don't see a world where we're educating people around mental health, the negatives and the positives around exercise, is a bad thing, because, you know,
of course.
Understanding the positives is great, because we can get people doing more exercise and being more physically happy, like a healthy, should I say, you know, like I said, I studied exercise nutrition. So, you know, exercise, health and stuff, I'm a big advocate for. But, you know, the same way, you know, educating around like suicide and things is really important, because, you know, people are more likely to reach out for help. Mm. We also need education about the, you know, the massive guy in the gym who can't look in the mirror because he thinks he's too small, or only feels himself when he's got a vest on doing bicep curls in the mirror. And the rest of the day, all he's thinking about is the gym and feeling that he's not muscular enough because he hasn't got a pump, you know, it's infecting his life with this like constant feeling of not being enough, to the point where he has to go to the gym 3 times a day, and it's breaking down his relationships, it's breaking down his work, it's breaking down his life, and no one talks about it. Like, we all just think, oh, he's in the gym all the time, it's great, he's physically healthy, like exercise is great for your mental health. It's like, you know, it needs to be spoken about, and that's what I'm trying to do with my own minds.
This is a brilliant segue actually into how the hell you've got a handle on all of this stuff. So moving kind of into like how you've kind of got out of your rut, and actually interesting for this podcast, for season one I tried to follow a very distinct framework for a conversation. Actually, it went out the window, which was quite lovely. But like, how the hell did you begin to bring yourself out of this place where you were got into?
Yeah. Okay. So it mostly started in my second year at university, where I hit what I would say is probably the peak of my poor mental health. And I, at that time, I'd kind of converted into binge eating disorder, which, people who don't know, basically similar to bulimia, where you, you know, binge eat, but you just don't have the purging behavior. So that's kind of what I was doing. I was just binge eating constantly. And I had what I now still refer to this day as the Leaning Tower of pizza, should I say, because I had pizza boxes that were, I'm like 6'2", and they were like up to my like shoulder from the floor. I had that many, because I just ordered pizza boxes and hadn't left my room for about 3 weeks or 2 weeks and a half or something. Like, there was an absurd amount of pizza boxes. I was basically sponsored by Domino's, although I paid for it all, which I still don't know how I paid for it by somehow.
But were you eating these pizza because you're kind of self-harming or what?
Yeah, unless I've read the research myself, I don't want to make the kind of claim, but I think that's similar to how it works. I think it is a form of
self-harming. It doesn't matter about the research, this is about your own mental
health.
You'll know in the moment have a load of feelings going through your mind, right?
Yeah, I think for me, yeah, it was lack of self-worth, and I think it was a, you know, eating pizza and stuff gives you like a dopamine spike, and it gave me a task as well. It gave me something to do to not think about my, like, how worthless I was, and, you know, all the bad things that I thought about myself. It gave me something else to do. So, you know, just eating and force feeding myself, you know, eating till I felt sick, you know, it was something to put on my mind. It distracted me from other stuff. That's basically how it worked, as far as I'm aware. And that's kind of where I think I've drawn the conclusion of it. I think that's what it is. And I say I'm talking like
How much were you eating a day?
My order usually was 2 large pizzas, a side of a chicken mix box or something, like a side of like loads of chicken and stuff. Then 2 pots of Ben and Jerry's and one of the brownies, and I'd normally eat that. And then sometimes
in one sitting.
Yeah. Yeah. At the start I would do that in the morning, and then I'd sometimes eat other stuff like from the shop, or like, you know, chocolate bars or whatever. But like later on, like I was so full and so stuffed that like I would just eat that basically in the day, which I'm saying like that's not much, but you know, it's hard to remember because I think my mind's kind of pushed it out of my head. But yeah, it was a lot of food. I don't know how many calories that is, but I'm sure someone can do the maths. But yeah, it was a lot. But then, yeah, so the kind of how I came out of it was I started seeing, in my second year at uni, started seeing a counsellor.
What prompted you to do that?
I think it was the Leaning Tower of Pizza Boxes. I, I, I remember coming downstairs and one of my housemates, because my housemate, we were called the gym house because I was like really into bodybuilding and like lifting and stuff because like my muscle dysmorphia stuff. And one of my other housemates was powerlifter / strongman kind of guy, and he was like big beard and like listens to screamo music and stuff. He's also actually like a poet and like the really nice guy. So you know, but my other housemate was a GB Olympic weightlifter. And probably one of the smartest people I've ever met in my entire life. But we were known as like this gym house because all of us, we basically covered every form of strength sports that was in this house. And I remember I came downstairs and I hadn't seen, bearing in mind this is a teeny tiny house, I hadn't seen my housemate for the 2 weeks, like probably about 2 weeks, because I was just in my room stuffing myself with food.
And but I came were you down going out, sorry to interrupt, but like you say that and... Your story is interesting because it you've got compulsive exercise mixed in with all of this, and you say you were in your room for 2.5 weeks. Like, were you leaving to train or not?
So, this is kind of interesting, and this is something that I was going to come on to, but I might as well skip to it now. But that when I was working with my counselor, one of the things that we found was that I had what we termed, like, I'm sure it was something else within the kind of psychology science, but I don't know, but we termed it the good George and the bad George. So I had two states. I had the good George, which is the George that I displayed to people. So if people, you know, I was almost like a compulsive liar. If you asked me a question about something that had gone badly for me, I was so scared that if people knew negative things about me, they would hate me, that I would just lie. Like not even consciously. Like, it's so hard to explain that because people say, well, you know, you had to make it up, so obviously you did it consciously, but it was just a gut response. Like, I can't tell you the truth because it's negative. Like, if you ask me what mark I got on one of my uni assignments, or you ask me what I ate for my lunch or whatever, I couldn't tell you that I ate, you know, something that was, you know, air quotes, unhealthy, or I couldn't tell you that I didn't get a first in that exam or first in that piece of work. I just instantly said, oh, I got a first, or I instantly said, yeah, I did really well, or I instantly said that, yeah, I ate salad or chicken and rice or whatever. And, you know, I was just compulsively lying about it. But yeah, when I started binge eating and stuff, that was the bad George in my head. So he didn't exercise. He didn't do uni work. He didn't. So when I was binge eating, I hid in my room because I was the bad George, and I couldn't let anyone see that. So I couldn't go to the gym, but the bad George didn't go to the gym. He just ate shit and felt shit about himself and was worthless. And that's, he just stayed in his room and hid until the good George could come out and be.
Assumingly as well, under a shroud of depression.
Yeah, it's shame. Shame's, you know, it's just, people often talk within binge eating disorder, a big thing you talk about is this, I forget the word they use, but you're kind of, it's like an out of body experience when you're eating, because it's, at the time, it just feels like this desperation, you're just eating and, you know, you feel like you need to do it. But then when you've finished and you look back at yourself, it's almost like it wasn't yourself. Like, cause you know at the time that you're going to regret it, and you know, you're going to hate it. And every time you do it, you know, you're going to hate it, but then you finish and you look back and you're like, why did I do that? Like, who was that person? Like, it just wasn't, it didn't feel like it was me. Like, I felt different. I wasn't thinking the same. I wasn't acting the same. And you just become so ashamed of who that person. And that was the bad George, you know, that was the guy that I couldn't let anyone know about or see, or, you know, and it was terrifying. And you know, obviously with all that eating, especially when it went on for 2-3 weeks, I used to put on weight. And that's why the thing I was going to say was, you know, I came downstairs, hadn't seen my housemate for a couple of weeks. And I remember he said, he said like, you look massive. And he meant it like, as in like big, like muscular, because like I'd blown up because normally when I was being the good George, air quotes, I was in like really healthy foods, air quotes again, you know, I was eating really like clean foods and, you know, eating a calorie deficit because of that, you know, so I was leaning out and, you know, and getting leaner. So then when I started eating loads and binge eating, my muscles like would blow up, and I would look like, I would obviously put on some body fat, but I would look considerably bigger. And yeah, and I just remember him saying that, and he meant it in a positive way, and he didn't really know about my eating disorder. And then, like, even if he did, like, you know, people can't understand that, and I don't resent anyone for saying anything wrong to me. Like, because they just, it's really like, even I don't know what you're supposed to say to me, so how can anyone else? But no. It hit me for six, like massively. And yeah, and I just remember I think my face went bright red and I started sweating because I was just so like ashamed. And yeah, that moment really stands out to me. But yeah, that was really shit. And then I think I just ordered another pizza and went upstairs. But yeah, so when I was kind of in that bad George mode, I was just in my room eating, and the bathroom was right next to my room. So I'd just go to the bathroom there. I wouldn't shower or anything for like weeks. Like, cause I didn't think I was worthy of it. Like, I didn't think I was worthy of showering, and you know, I was just basically, like you're saying, just kind of like self-harm. Like, I just didn't think I was worthy of any of the things that a human should have. Like, I just, all I do is eat and that's it. Like, so yeah, it just took over my life.
How does it make you feel now thinking about it?
How does it make me feel? It makes me feel, I kind of get it because I understand like why I did it. You know, like I said, I had this lack of self-worth, and a big part of me getting better is increasing my mindfulness and understanding how my brain works and how I think. And, you know, I had such a negative thought process continuously, and I just never understood, you know, because of this like childhood experiences of not understanding social ways that people communicate, etc. I never understood how people could still like you if you told them something bad that you did or something that you were doing wrong. Like, I, in my head, if I told you that I ate cake or like ate like an entire, you know, a couple of days ago, I ate like half a golden syrup cake. You know, like those cakes. I ate like a half of one. And that's like, people do shit like that all the time. But you know, back then, if the idea of telling you that, I would instantly think I'm fucking insane and you'll hate me and that you judge me and you look down on me. And, you know, because that's the way my life was for me. It was a constant chase of keeping people away from realizing the bad things that I'd done and the ways that I wasn't perfect. I wasn't the good George.
Wow. Counseling.
Yes. Sorry.
No. I mean, I'm in awe of it. It's, I don't think I've ever had an eating disorder. I definitely relate to muscle dysmorphia. Mm-hmm. It's never translated into a eating disorder, but it has made me feel shit.
Yeah, yours is like
I dread to think how common, how many people go through this. Mm. And at various stages and degrees of severity.
Mm. Well, it's important as well to remember that, because, you know, for people listening who, you know, are struggling with eating disorders, one thing that gave me some kind of hope, and I think is something that people don't understand, is that eating disorders are a continuum. There is like, it's not a binary thing. You don't just have one and then don't have one. You know, we all go on the spectrum at some stage. You know, on one side is that complete, like, you know, loving your body and eating intuitively and eating, you know, in a healthy manner with the right amount of calories, etc. You know, on the other side is anorexia, bulimia, binge eating disorder, etc. But in the middle, there's, you know, yo-yo dieting, feeling ashamed of yourself for the way you eat, the way you eat, you know, you're being ashamed of your body, the way you look, like thinking you're too fat or whatever. You know, those are kind of disordered eating tendencies. They don't mean you have an eating disorder, but, you know, it shows, you know, that there is that continuum. We all flow between, like, right now, I wouldn't say that I have an eating disorder, like, technically, like, because I haven't had like a proper binge eating episode in like probably a couple months or like, yeah. So, you know, right now I'm probably more in the center. You know, I'm still a little bit body conscious at times, and you know, I'm still a bit conscious about how I eat. Like, sometimes, you know, I won't eat specific foods because I think, oh, that, you know, might be a bit too high calorie for right now or whatever, and you know, I get concerned about that. you know, but I wouldn't say I'm an eating disorder right now. But yeah, so it is a continuum, and that's important for people to remember. But I'm, again, I go off on so many tangents. I just find this stuff so interesting. Like this is my shit. You know, this is I love this stuff. Counseling. So I started seeing this guy who I'll refer to as Ed, who was my counselor. He had an Irish accent and a big beard, and he was a lovely man. And I've seen a few counselors, and I understand that you have to kind of gel with them, and it isn't for everything, but I am such a huge advocate for counseling.
Were you back then though?
My family have all, I've always been brought up to, I was told to, you should speak about your feelings, and you should talk about it. And my mum always said that, you should talk about your feelings. There's a boundary, and it's something that you might experience this yourself, and it might be something that being a mental health advocate and being someone on social media who's a mental health advocate, you often develop a autopilot of mental health things that you share. So if someone asks me about my mental health, I say, yeah, I had an disorder and I suffer with depression, anxiety sometimes. And yeah, sometimes I just feel a bit shit. I'm not actually sharing anything. All I'm just saying the things that I've said a million times, and there's no emotion behind it. You're
just sharing your own narrative, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And you're not actually sharing how you feel. You're just sharing what's happened to you, and you've done that a million times. It just becomes this autopilot where, we can hide behind that. And that's kind of how I was before I started seeing my counselor, where I'd say to people, I had this issue when I was a child and stuff, and there's some stuff that haunts me, but whatever, like it's fine. Like I deal with it. And it wasn't until I started seeing my counselor that I started to actually open up and actually, we all have those things in the back of our heads, or the things that we think about, that we think if we told anyone, we'd be in, like, they'd be put in like an insane asylum or whatever. We all have them. Everyone listening to this podcast has thought something or done something or whatever that they think if they tell anyone that they did that, then people would think they're insane and everyone would hate them. But we all do it, So having a counselor, having a professional person that's there to listen to that shit is incredible. And if I could afford it, I would pay for a counselor my entire life. So we started with a thing. It's kind of similar to a thing called narrative therapy, which is where you write out your story and then you kind of break it down with like the therapist, and you kind of, you understand your own story better. It's very difficult to, the way that kind of works, or at least from my experience and from what I've read and heard, it's very difficult to think within your own head, because to really think, you have to weigh things up. So you have to, you have to look at one side and you have to look at the other side, and you have to see your experience and then decide where it goes on that continuum of if it's a good or a bad event, etc. When it's in your head, it's very easy to skip over things. So I'm trying to think of an example. So, I could say that, I didn't do well on an exam, and in my head, I'm like, I didn't do well on that exam. I know that not doing well on an exam means that I did bad. That means I'm a bad person. That means I'm worthless. When you write it down, you write, I didn't do well on that exam. That means I'm a bad person. And you look at it and you go, that's not fucking true. Like what, like that's like, you look at it and you're just like that, like there's so many more things about me. Like it's one exam. It's, and honestly, it's like people who hadn't journaled or written down on like things that they're confused about, just do it. Like if you get anything from this podcast, do that, write it down. It's like night and day. Honestly, it's ridiculous.
I had one recently, and I don't think she'll mind me sharing this, but about, with my girlfriend and she got in the car, I picked her up. She was having a couple of drinks with somebody, a couple of people, work colleagues. I picked her up and I saw a name pop up on her phone and that I know she's had some history with. And I just immediately in my head, I lost my shit. I was like going down various different avenues of, okay, she's got drunk and she started messaging this guy. Okay, why has she done that? Because she feels like she can only message him when she's away from me. And then why, where does that go? Okay, well, basically
She's cheating on me and I'm worthless and I am not good enough. And this guy who I've said I have a bit of an issue with, which is my problem anyway, it's got nothing to do with her because she's done absolutely nothing wrong. So I went into this cloud of it was my typical black cloud of, this is it, I'm done. What's the point in this? And you go there from 0 to 100 and you can never stop. I really struggled to stop it. And then in the morning, we'd had a fight. She was still a bit pissed, but like that evening, and we'd had a bit of a fight and falling out. And I just wasn't myself. In the morning, I got up. I get up early anyway. She slept in, came into the kitchen. I was like, that was wrong last night. And so now I'm going to sit here and journal from the very moment she got in the car, what my emotional state was, where my thoughts went to. And then I'm going to sit down, break them down and challenge every single one of them. And I did. It took me about an hour because I had so many thoughts going through my head. And then as soon as she woke up, I said, I need to speak to you about something. This is why I was grumpy last night. And this is where what had happened. And the power of journaling down my thoughts, being able to challenge them in a way which was rational and not irrational, and being able to understand where this went wrong and actually was it reality? I think the big thing, like you might agree, is often our mind doesn't have the ability to understand what's reality and what's not. From my experience with therapy, especially with anxiety, is our consciousness is obviously linked directly to our unconsciousness, and we go into trance-like states all the time, right? When you're daydreaming, you're in a trance. You're not in a conscious world, you're in an unconscious mind. And that is where our minds basically have three outputs, as I understand it, which is a voice, pictures and videos, and they all become merged into one. And so when we're really anxious, it might be that we've got a phobia of snakes, and snakes come on the TV because you're watching I'm a Celeb on a Wednesday night, and then this triggers this video that plays out in your consciousness, which is oh my god, that snake's going to eat me. But actually, when you stop and think and challenge that thought, which is in essence, yes, just a thought, and that's the most important thing, but you begin to say, right, in my mind, I'm seeing a video and pictures and a voice of me being bitten, attacked by a snake, or whatever it might be. Actually, what that is just thought, and that is not the reality, because the reality is I'm sat in front of a very nice 60-inch Samsung TV on a Wednesday night watching I'm a Celeb, which is in halfway the other side of the world at 9 o'clock in the evening. That is not the reality I'm in. And that's what you've kind of gone through is like understanding that this isn't the reality, and it's understanding as I see it, is like, this isn't the George that is reality. This is a George, which is in my mind. And it's a James, which is in my mind as well. It's like, this isn't the real James. And when actually you look at challenging, have you heard of a guy called Peter Crone?
I don't think so. I may have done. I'm really bad.
Like he's a really, really cool guy. You should look him up. I'd say to everybody, you should go and like watch some of his. He's been on like Aubrey. I don't know if you look at more Aubrey Marcus, listen to his podcast as well. Peter Crone talks about unlimiting your unconscious from limiting belief systems. So like for you and me, self-worth is like, and the feeling of not being good enough, like that cascades into this whole like limiting belief system, which basically means that I can't function and you start eating pizza. And for me, like understanding that is just a figment of my imagination, that I'm not good enough, is complete bollocks. But how you put in place the processes to remind yourself and come back into the reality, which is the most interesting part. It's also the most difficult part because it takes a shitload of practice, and most people don't particularly want to put in the practice. That's what I found.
I think kind of the way that I've simply put that in my head is that your thoughts aren't fact. Just because you think something is the case. And, you know, a really good example of this is, you know, when you first start texting someone new and you don't know how they text. And so a perfect example is if you just put the word okay with nothing. For some people, if you just put okay, that's like, I'm fucking pissed off. And you've some people, it don't mean shit. And that's kind of the way that your brain is working is I've experienced this thing, you know, that okay is a negative thing. And now I'm seeing okay in front of me. From my experience, that means the world's going to end. This is a terrible moment. But actually, that's just your thought. That's just your brain. That's just it doing its thing. You know, it's seeing an experience. It's making up a story. It's giving you this output. But it doesn't necessarily mean that's fact, because for that person who sent you the text, maybe just sending an okay.
No, they've got a completely different experience of sending that text to you.
Exactly. Exactly. And it's the same way, you know, like you were saying then with your girlfriend, like from your perspective, it seemed like the world is going to end and it was this horrible catastrophe thing. But from her perspective, it wasn't anything. You just got angry for whatever reason.
From her perspective, she's walked in the car and she has had too much to drink. That's it.
Yeah, yeah.
And do you know what the other? You've reminded me there of another way in which, as I suppose, what are we, Gen Z or Gen X, or I've lost. I don't know, one of them. Yeah, yeah. One of those. As those have actually progressed, and we've formed different levels or different types of generation societies within those generations. The role of the full stop has changed so dramatically. In the English language, the role of a full stop is to end a sentence. Yeah, actually, if somebody puts a full stop on a text, you're like, oh my word, this person is unbelievably mad at me. My mum does it all the time. I often have to ask her, please stop doing that, because it makes me feel uncomfortable.
Yeah.
That is ridiculous.
Weird? Isn't that
How weird?
Weird
is that?
Yeah.
That's amazing, really, when you think about it. The role of the full stop has progressed into a negative, something so small and so fundamental to English literature and language structure.
That's the danger of emojis and stuff as well, isn't it? Like, you know, emojis mean different things to different people, you know. Like the perfect example is the aubergine emoji. Like, you know, you put an aubergine, it's just a piece of, there's just a vegetable, but you know, now,
well, actually you put it's funny you say that. If you put an aubergine on a screen, it's not an aubergine, is it?
No, exactly. Yeah,
it's your experience.
Add a peach. The peach emoji means an arse now.
It's a pixel, and it's a piece of code.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Breaking it down even more. Yeah. It's very interesting. It's very interesting. I love that kind of stuff. The way that we. It's our own perception of reality, isn't it? And you know, our own perception of how things are working, and that's all we're doing, isn't it? Everyone's just guessing. Our brain's just telling us shit, and we're just guessing.
I was having a discussion with a friend the other day about whether we're living in a simulation.
Simulation theory. Yeah, I've heard about this.
I don't know. Is the answer, and for people listening to this, being like, "What the fuck." If I said to you that we're living in a simulation, you'd be like, "What? You're mental. You're a fucking idiot." But show me proof that we're not. Yeah. And he was then saying how his really good friend is into these theories, and how he was saying, actually, if you break it down even further, he doesn't even know. I don't even know, George, if you're real, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And like, I haven't ever met you properly. Mm-hmm. I've seen you on the end of a text, and I've seen you on the end of my Zoom, but I don't actually know if you're real.
Yeah. Yeah.
When you think of that, it's mad. You have no proof to suggest that you're real. Like, you have no proof to suggest that I'm real.
Yeah. Well, you could go even further and say, you know, technically, you know, everything that you're feeling, seeing, hearing, tasting, smelling, etc., are just little like electrical signals in your brain.
Yeah. So, like, we're just atoms vibrating. Yeah,
you know what's really cool, which I love, is the fact that it takes your brain like to be able to kind of take the data of what the light that it's seen and then turn it into a visual image, it takes your brain I don't know the exact time, but like, let's say like 0.1 of a second to be able to present that to you. So we're actually constantly seeing 0.1 of a second behind delay. Delay of what's actually happening. How weird is that?
It's mental. I would want to quickly just, we've been going now for an hour and a half, and I'm not going to cut us off too quickly, but this kind of next segment for me is quite important because it kind of goes into the essence of the podcast actually, which is like, what kind of stuff do you put in place from a mental health perspective, from a, I suppose, structural perspective, to keep your eating disorders at bay? Like when you went through, you obviously went through therapy, what did you work on to, I suppose, become okay?
Yeah. Well, for me, it was beginning that narrative therapy and understanding my kind of past and realizing that I'm not worthless, and, you know, I'm not, you know, just breaking down my life and uncovering it from, you know, with written stuff and by sharing things and talking to people about it. It instantly kind of showed me that I wasn't this worthless, awful human being. And, you know, at least not, you know, my brain's still tries to pull me back into that occasionally, you know, if something shows up that proves to me that, or like, you know, is a form of proof that, okay, yeah, I am worthless, then my brain goes, oh, we've got it again. We were right before, you know, before those couple of years ago when we thought we were worthless, turns out we're right. Cause you know, you just see this thing and that proves it. But then you kind of, you know, it's an analog thing. Over time, you start to recognize that quicker and you start to be able to resolve it faster. And you know, it used to be if something like that happened, then, you know, for 2 weeks I would feel like shit and I would binge eat and stuff. Whereas now if that happens to me, I feel like shit for 10 minutes or 20 minutes and then I'd turn it around.
But then what do you do?
So what do I do? Journaling is my biggest thing. 100%. Like, writing stuff down, turning my, this like negative thinking, whatever it is, turning it into a physical manifestation, something that I can't overthink. I can't keep repeating, you know, I just get it on paper. That helps me so much. I also meditate a lot, like working on mindfulness, understanding how I think, highlighting to myself the fact that, you know, I do go to the worst possible outcome. Like I don't think of the rational possible thing. I don't, if someone looks at me funny, I don't think, oh, they just looked at me funny. I think, oh, they probably hate me. You know, and now I don't do that as often. Now I think, you know, they probably, you know, the amount of times I've looked up and been pulling a funny face at someone and then looked away, and I didn't mean shit to me. You know, you start to kind of clock on to these little things.
Yes, of course.
And I think, like I said, eating disorders are a mental health issue. They're a behavior you do to try and fix something else, like some kind of, you know, lack of self-worth or whatever. So it's just, my eating disorder's just kind of like slowly gone away as I've started to understand my own mental health and started to just kind of reduce this, or well, improve this self-worth that I have. And, you know, it's just slowly kind of gone. Like, I can't really explain it. I just don't have the urge to do it as much now. There is also like stuff like, you know, I practice intuitive eating and I practice kind of working on my like emotional eating and being present when I eat, like, you know, like actually focusing on how I eat and, you know,
that's interesting. What do you mean?
This is something I run with my other 10 million things that I do. I run a, nutritional/exercise coaching business on the side, and I work with some people around like emotional eating and stuff. And the idea is like,
what's it called?
It's Coached by Judah, because my nickname's Judah. So it's right, just okay. It's just something to get me a bit of money, because my minus doesn't make me much money. The consultancy I do for a charity, I don't make much money, although I love doing it and I love like teaching people about these things that I'm talking about here. But it don't make me a lot of money. So, you know, it's just something just to get me money whilst I'm looking for other jobs and stuff. If anyone out there listening has a research job going, please hook me up. Thank you. I forgot what I was saying. What was I talking about?
Coaching.
Oh, yes. Yeah. So, yeah. So, yeah, I coach, like, I try and help people with emotional eating. And the way that I did it and the way that I try and do with my clients is I do what's kind of called like mood mapping along with the way they eat. So basically you just, as you're eating, I use like an app. I can't remember the name of the app now. Sorry, the people who made the app, but they take a picture of their food or they write down what they ate. I try not to get them to weigh stuff out and things because I think that's, I think that can have a negative effect.
So a big no to MyFitnessPal.
That's it's my personal opinion. There are some studies, my master's degree that I did my study on was looking at muscle dysmorphia and disordered eating in relation to tracking diet and tracking exercise. And my study showed that people who tracked their exercise tended to have high levels of muscle dysmorphia and high levels of disordered eating. So in my study, that seemed to be the case, but you could argue that, you know, it not necessarily like correlation doesn't equal causation. Just because they both happen to be high in both those cases doesn't mean that that causes it. Like it could just be that, you know, it so happens that people with more disordered eating then tend to track or whatever. But you know, it's just my opinion. There's a lot of kind of research, and there's actually a video on my mind's that I did where I talk about my opinion. I go full depth into it. I couldn't do it justice here because I'd need to like look at my notes and like go through everything. I do not off the top of my head. It's a very complex opinion I have. But yeah, so I my personal opinion is that it's negative, so I'd try not to do it. But yeah, so I get people to like write down like just what they've ate. So like, you know, I had lasagna and I had whatever, blah blah blah. And then they also track like how hungry they felt during it. Like before it, how hungry they felt after, and what mood they had when they were eating it. Like, were they happy, sad, angry? Whatever. They talk about how mindful they were when they were eating it. So were they, whilst they're eating it, were they playing on their phone? Whilst they're eating it, were they watching a movie? Or were they sat there? Were they enjoying every bite and enjoying the food and you know, chewing it and tasting it? You know, how did they behave around it?
How important is that?
It's unbelievably important for like a healthy relationship with food.
Yeah, but I wouldn't say I have an unhealthy relationship with food because I sit in front of the TV and watch.
Oh yeah,
and not, watch food and watch TV while I eat. Like
yeah, not that I don't think. I think if you're having an issue with it, then it's right, probably, okay. it's a really.
But what? But why thing. Is mindfulness? What? Why is that in particular so important?
Well, from my opinion, and I, the went to when you're eating, when you eat food and you chew, it basically your brain sends signals of satiety. So like how full you are, you know, and you know, how this food's making you feel. If you're distracting yourself from that, then you're probably going to eat faster, which is not going to allow those hormones to kind of do their thing, or at least not in time. So it tends to mean you're going to overeat. And then when you overeat, that can lead to, you know, weight gain, or that can lead to, you know, you just having gastrointestinal issues, etc. So more, it's more the idea of getting that mindfulness is the idea that you begin to eat an amount that makes more sense and is required, though, like what you actually, it's the word I'm looking for. You're eating an amount that is suits kind of how you actually feel, rather than, you know, emotionally eating or eating too much. So then the clients that I do this with are people who come to me who say that they, you know, when they're stressed, they eat loads of food, or, you know, sure. And they're struggling to lose weight. But I genuinely
and is there a correlation between when people are stressed and they are binge eating that they're not mindful when they're eating, or they are?
I don't know about within the research itself, but there is a lot of kind of mindfulness. There's mindfulness campaign, like there's research that looks at using mindfulness programs to reduce disordered eating and reduce binge eating.
So you haven't collected any like anecdotal, like, client.
Not. I've only just started with my coaching. So it's only I've only been running it 2 months. Mm. It's worked on myself and it's worked on people.
Mm. Okay. Well, with yourself, was there a direct correlation between
100%.
Stress, binge eating, and being, or was it being mindful or just totally being in a completely different world?
I think, yeah, it's because like I said before, often when I was binge eating or, you know, overeating, I wasn't present. Almost, it was almost like something that, you know, I was someone else.
Right.
And I think, yeah, I think as well for me, you know, just slowing down. You know, something that I often say is you eat, take a bite of food, put it in your mouth, then put your cutlery down and chew it and eat it. And like enjoy the food. You actually get more enjoyment out of the food because you start to recognize the textures and the flavors, and you actually start to enjoy your food more, for one. So that's the bonus. And you know, two, if you're
I'm gonna do that this evening. I've got chicken, I've got HelloFresh chicken Kiev's gonna be cooked tonight, and I'm gonna do that later.
Oh, sounds fantastic. Honestly though, it's actually that's a crazy thing. If you put your phone down, turn the TV off and eat your food and focus on your food, because it's what, like 10, 20 minutes out of your life. You know, focus on your food.
It's nothing.
You'll be shocked the kind of enjoyment you get out of it, and the things that you experience that you didn't before, that you hadn't experienced previously. I think overall it's help. It gives you as well. It's almost like it's a break in the hectic life. It's like it's a moment of kind of respite, because we're always trying to fill our minds with stimulus. And I think, you know, allowing yourself to just mealtime is mealtime, and that's it. It's not mealtime, email time, watching TV time, and whatever time. You know, it's just, I'm just going to eat, and I'm going to think about my food, and I'm going to enjoy my food, and that's going to be it. You know, especially for people who, you know, like I said, I usually do this for people who are overeating or emotional eating. You know, it'll help with you feeling more full. You know, it'll help with you, you know, enjoying your meals more. You know, you may even start to enjoy foods that you didn't previously enjoy. You know, I used to, a weird one with me, I don't really understand how this worked, but I never used to like broccoli that much. And then when I started being more mindful when I eat it, now I love broccoli, because I appreciate the texture of it more and the flavor of it. And I actually really enjoy it now when I eat it, because I think about it. Whereas before, I'd put it on my mouth and I'd just be like, it would just be like a necessity. Like I eat it because it's good for me. Whereas now I actually enjoy broccoli. So
interesting. Fascinating. What makes George Michael, George Michael?
that is a big question. What makes me?
Having gone through this period, I suppose what I'm getting at there with that question is, having gone through this experience, having gone through the journey of life that you've gone through, and there's a load more to come, like what makes George Mycock, George Mycock, like right now?
I think right now it's my drive and my I hate the word passion, because everyone says passion, but I think that's the only word I can think of. But my want to do what I'm doing, and my love for doing it. And that's something that, like, at the moment, like, I've just finished my master's, and you know, I've got all these, you know, at the moment I'm doing so much. I'm working, like, I don't want to say for certain, but I'm probably going to say like 10, 11 hour days or something, which is not massive, but it's quite big. It's not massive for what I've done in the past, but I'm working a lot of hours in the day, and I'm not really, I don't really have that much to show for it, like money wise or like financial wise, or, you know, like obviously
join,
don't get me
join
wrong,
the
like,
club.
obviously what I'm doing with My Minds, I love it. The podcasts that I'm doing with My Minds, I love them. The fact that I'm getting to teach people through the charity that I'm working with, First Steps, you know, I'm getting to teach people about the things that I've talked about today, compulsive exercise, disordered eating, etc. The fact that I'm helping people with their emotional eating, I'm helping people within the gym, and you know, I'm helping people. The fact that I'm managing to help people, I'm so, so grateful for. But you know, you do have to get some kind of financial thing. And my goal, like, what I want to do is I want to work in research. I want to be doing research. And, you know, one day I would love, like, a dream of mine in however long it takes is for to be the kind of MyoMinds Research Institute, or MyoMinds Research, you know, where I research exercise and mental health and help people with this and further understand this kind of stuff. And you know, whether that's through my own research in a uni, or, you know, if I can ever set up a MyoMinds kind of research thing, we'll see. But yeah, I think that's what makes me is that just drive to be what I want to be, and trying to enjoy the process along the way. That's something I really struggle struggle with is enjoying it. Like, not that I don't enjoy it, but allowing myself to, like we were talking about, you know, you're constantly, everyone focuses on the negatives. I'm constantly focused on the fact that I didn't get the PhD this year, and I want to, I'm to apply next year, or, I'm not getting the research jobs that I'm applying for. And, but I'm also forgetting the fact that, I'm teaching some medical professionals about the thing I love. I'm doing podcasts with really interesting people. I'm on the rut. This is cool shit. Like, this is really cool and I should be proud of it. I'm constantly being like, yeah, but I'm not doing a PhD. I'm not doing these things that I want to do.
I'm like that.
Yeah. It's really difficult. I thought of this, and this is very much off topic, but I thought it was quite a funny anecdote. It's funny that because you said, what makes George Mycock George Mycock? And I was on the radio the other day, like BBC radio, and they didn't put my last name in the broadcast. They asked me for my last name, and I was like, Mycock, and they were like, I'll leave that out. because my name is just horrendous. Sorry, it's a bit of a sad note, but yeah. I thought that was funny because the person was on the phone, they were like, what's your last name? I was like, Mycock. And like, what? I'm like, yeah, my cock. And then they were like, okay, do you mind if we leave that out? And I was like, okay. And then
left
it out, which is fair. Yeah.
As is always obligatory now in season two, or whenever this goes out, to be honest, I have five questions that I finish with.
Okay, let's do it.
Five questions that I finish with. Number one, what's your favorite book and why?
Ooh, that's really tough.
I'm paid, well, not really, to ask tough questions.
I'm going to go with How to Win Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie. Is it Dale Carnegie? Yeah. Is that right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Fantastic book. I love the way it's written, in the fact that it's kind of like anecdotal, and there's like all these different stories. And I love the fact that it's examples of how these things have taken place. Mm. I'm a big kind of, because I'm sure you've realized and people have realized this, I'm a big research fan, and I'm a big kind of case study fan. And I like things. It helps me understand things when I have an example of it happening. And that book, it's the book I've read the most times. I think I've read it like probably five or six times.
Have you read Man Up by Jack Irwin?
No, I don't think so.
You should read that if you're, you go and Google that. And also The Book of Joy. I don't know if you've read that. Yeah.
I have so many, but I'm currently reading How to Be an Anti-Racist, which is actually really interesting. And I'm really enjoying that. Me and my girlfriend are doing, she's reading... Why I'm No Longer Speaking to White People About Race, or something like that.
Oh yeah.
But we're both reading a kind of like racism-esque book, and then we're going to like compare notes. So that'd be interesting. But yeah, she's like as much the nerd as I am. So we're just kind of nerding out together. Yeah.
Question two: what lesson have you learnt in your life that you know is true, but you kind of hate?
Oh, these are great questions. I love this. That you have, I think for me anyway, I have to make myself uncomfortable in order to progress. I have to do things that scare the shit out of me in order to progress, because there's a small part of my brain that always just thinks like it would be easier if I just didn't bother going for a PhD, or like, because for me, my whole education journey has been kind of into nutrition stuff, and I love it and I find it really interesting, but now I really want to work in mental health, and I kind of kicking myself for it, but it would be so much easier for me just to go, oh, I'm just going to work as a nutritionist and that's it. But to get to where I want to be, I have to make myself uncomfortable, and I have to do shit to get myself where I want to be. And I think that's it.
I like that. Really like that. Number three, your friend who's having a tough time at the moment picks up the phone, rings you and says he's having a really bad day today. Mm-hmm. What do you say?
I say, that's okay. It's normal. We all do. I've had it myself. We're having a shit time at some point today as well. So I'll probably tell them about that. I'll tell them that, do they want to speak to me about it? And also, I think this is a really good point. I would say to them, how do they want me to react? Do they want me to give advice? Do they want me just to listen? Do they want me to give them an example? Do they want me to whatever? Like, how do they want me to react to it? So I think that's a really clear thing that people, well, it's a really good point that people should do more often if you're talking about mental health with someone. And then my last bit of advice for them would be to go write it down.
Very nice.
Come in.
Yeah.
We have an intruder.
Intruder.
When you're struggling with something, struggling yourself, what's your go-to or what do you turn to improve things?
Journaling. 100%. Write it down. Ooh. Write it down. Yeah. I have one right behind me right now. I can't reach it because it's a little bit further away from me, but right behind me right now, I have a book. I have a journal within like every room of the house that I go to within the day, so that if I'm feeling shit, I immediately grab it and write it down. It just works for me. Like I've said, you know, it's like night and day. It's in my head. It's chaos. It's on a piece of paper. It's there. It's like, that's what it is. And I can deal with it.
I like it. I like it. Number five, you're lying on your deathbed looking back at your life. What are you most proud of?
My mind's being able to, originally it was just a place where people could share stories. It was just a place where we have like 78, I think, different stories from people within exercise and within sport. And it's now turned into this place where I speak to sport psychiatrists, I speak to mental health campaigners, speak to like elite athletes about mental health. And I can use my passion to, you know, right now I've recently started the Myo Minds lessons where I'm teaching people about muscle dysmorphia. I'm doing these like mini lectures, mini lessons, you know, and people are responding and people are, you know, whether it's one person or 1,000 people, you know, people are getting affected by it in some kind of way. And I'm so proud that I can do that because, like, you know, from what people have told me, I have helped people, and that's all I ever wanted from it. And yeah, that's what I'm most proud of, Myo Minds.
Go check it out.
Fantastic. It's been a whirlwind of a coming up to 2 hours now. So glad that we got to do this.
Finally,
I know,
after so long of us speaking about doing it, I'm so glad.
Thank you for, and God knows how many people will have listening when this gets released, but it doesn't matter. I mean, eating disorders is something that I really, really want to cover, and I'm just really, really proud that we were able to do this and shed some light on such a massive, but often I wouldn't say overlooked, but not relatively unspoken about subjects, and getting like quite the nitty gritty out and into the open, and seeing who we can get talking about this sort of stuff and get listening and understanding, and it's so critical.
Thank you so much for having me on. Like we said, we spoke about this before you actually started, and I remember thinking it was a great idea, and I was so excited for it to do it and being excited to come on. And the fact that it's kind of blown up as it has, and you've been having these people, you're doing an amazing thing, and you'll be helping so many people. And you, like you said yourself, it doesn't matter how many people are listening, because one person will listen and that person will get something out of it. I've got something out of it just speaking about this with you, you know, like, fuck if it's recording or not. Like, I don't like, I just enjoyed it just being like, if this was just me and you talking without the mics, I would have enjoyed it, and I've got something out of it. So like, you know, what more could you want from that?
Fabulous. Mr. Mycock, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for listening.